Meditation.
Depending on the quality of my mind.
You know, there's good days and bad days. And good days as well.
Feel like the waterfall of thoughts. And every now and then, a nice calm.
I can't think of anything.
This is Meditation in the City.
The Shambhala, New York podcast.
And I'm Dave, your host. And oh my God, there's so much I have to do. I overslept, right? And I've got to record this podcast, and I've got to upload it. And I've got to do laundry because I got to go to work tomorrow. And there's a class I got to get ready for Tuesday. It's just so much. I'm stressing out. Luckily, the topic of today's podcast is keeping your cool when you're stressed out. Did you like that? You saw what I did there, right? It was like a little play, like a little one-man show I just did for you there. Free of charge. Robert Chinder is the teacher on today's podcast. I'm not sure if this might be his first appearance, or certainly, if not that, a rare appearance on the podcast, which is unfortunate because Robert Chinder is a great meditation teacher, great guy. He is a lawyer. Oh, my God. Really? He's a lawyer. He teaches meditation to other lawyers, other businesses, and business groups. And he is a teacher at the Shambhala Meditation Center of New York. This was a talk he gave at the Weekly Dharma Gathering a couple of weeks ago. And it's great. Visit our website, ny.shambhala.org, for all of our upcoming classes and retreats in particular. You know about it. Our seven-day retreat, 7 days of mindfulness meditation, beginning August 18th. Just go to the website. Just read about it. Just check it out. You know it's a great thing to do. It's the teacher I can vouch for personally. He's great, Acharya Daniel Hesse. And, you know, maybe you'll want to sign up for a day or two, or maybe the whole retreat. Check it out. And now I've got to do all this stuff now. What am I going to do? What am I going to do, Robert? What am I going to do?
I think we're seeing a theme here, which is we get emotional and we act impulsively, or we get angry, or we fixate, or we do something that perhaps we think in retrospect wasn't such a great idea. So let's deconstruct what happens when we lose our cool. So first thing is that we get triggered by something. Something happens to cause us to have an emotion. And usually in a situation where we're losing our cool, it's some kind of a threat. So it could be a threat to our sense of ourselves and our sense of being right or wrong. Or it could be a threat to our version of ourself that we don't think that we can or want to do a long retreat, or whatever it is that makes us perhaps have regret, which causes us to hold on to it and ruminate on and on. And it, you know, in fact, in evolutionary biology terms, we can actually pinpoint this in the brain, which is that we have this it's kind of an almond-shaped structure in the brain called the amygdala. And the amygdala is what responds to threat. So every vertebrate has an amygdala. It's called also called the lizard brain. So lizards have it and humans have it. And the way it works is, like, imagine you're walking in the savannah a million years ago and you see a saber-toothed tiger. Well, you're going to do one of three things. You're going to fight, which is probably not a good idea. You're going to flee, maybe up a tree. Maybe that's a good idea. Or you're going to freeze, and you hope the tiger doesn't see you. Okay, so three choices. And then if you don't get eaten or hurt, then the tiger goes away, and then you continue on, and you're the threat is no longer there, so you don't have this fight, flee, or freeze response anymore, and then you continue. Now, what's happened to us is that in the 21st century, as opposed to the 999th century before us, we're in a very different situation. And while there are external threats, there are actually also internal threats. So we might get triggered by something we think about. So when we're meditating, we remember, oh, I wish I hadn't done that. And we're threatened by that. So we have this freeze or flee sensation or even fight sensation internally. So the more, you know, for those of you who have been meditating for a long time, you'll know what I mean. But we can just sit there for hours and hours and hours and beat ourselves up about things that we should have done or didn't do or are afraid of or hope for even. And there's nothing going on. And we always come back. We notice the distraction. We come back to now and we notice that there's a little bit of a gap. There's nothing happening. Literally, when we meditate, we're doing nothing. So what we're training ourselves to do is to notice that we're doing nothing, as opposed to being in the land of our emotion. Now, this isn't to say that there's a problem with emotions. So let's talk about that a little bit. What's an emotion? Anybody want to give me a definition of what an emotion is? I suppose you don't say, I know it when I feel it. Tell me what an emotion is. Anybody? Any scientists in the room? Yes.
It's a physiological response that your body has to some external or internal circumstance.
Yep. Scientist, right?
kind of. I don't know. Kinda,
yeah. It's a physiological response to an internal or external stimulus. Usually we think of emotions as some kind of a thought that's really intense. But if we deconstruct it, it's actually a physiological response plus a thought pattern, right? So if we feel angry, we might feel it in our chest or in our throat. Or if we feel happy, we might feel it in our arms and in our hearts. There was a study in Finland a few years ago where a lot of people of different ethnic backgrounds were shown different stimuli meant to produce a particular emotion, and then they were asked to color in where in their bodies they felt the emotion. And remarkably, it was very consistent. And if you are in your bodies and you can sort of notice where you feel different sensations when you're feeling an emotion, you can actually start to pinpoint how you feel at any given time and actually label it with, I feel regret, I feel fear, I feel anger. A lot of times, at least in my case, I might feel an emotion, I might feel a physical sensation and think, well, what's going on? And then maybe I can get into my body and actually notice that, you know, 10 minutes ago I was triggered by something. I experienced a threat or some other kind of trigger, and then my emotions kicked in, and now I can actually sort of figure out what I'm feeling. So there's a trigger, there's a threat, there's an emotion. Emotion is anger, it's dissociation, or it could be desire. Desire actually manifests in some cases as addiction, because if we feel something that's painful, our desire is to flee. And addiction's always about fleeing. It's always about, how can I get away from how I feel? How can I not feel how I'm feeling now? I'm going to go and have a drink. I'm going to go and have sex. I'm going to go and do drugs. I'm going to go back to work. I'm going to go shopping. Whatever it is. And all of those things, you know, in small doses can be great. But if we imbue them with our ability to be happy, in other words, if we say, I can only be happy when I'm doing that, whether it's conscious or unconscious, that's when it becomes an addiction. Video games is another one. So what do we do? How do we notice the cycle, and how do we work with it? Losing our cool is when we get to the fight, flee, or freeze part. When it's not a saber-toothed tiger. When it's our boss coming in the room, and we might freeze. We might feel like fleeing. Or we might feel like, you know, punching our boss in the nose. Or anybody that we have a hard time with. So what happens when we meditate? We're just sitting there. We're paying attention to our breath. And we get distracted. And our distraction is something. It's, I'm bored. What's going on after class tonight? Or it's, I feel terrible about what I did, or I'm not a good person, or so-and-so makes me really angry. Could be anything. So the instruction is, you notice the thought. You label it thinking. So you just say to yourself, thinking. That's a way of just creating a boundary. And then, this is the important part, very kindly, without judgment, without any recrimination, we just bring our attention back to our breathing. And it's very simple. It's the simplest thing in the world. Not so easy, but simple. And then we pay attention to our breathing. And it doesn't mean necessarily the thought or the emotion goes away, but we're experiencing whatever we're experiencing in the present. When we're distracted, it means we're in the future or we're in the past. The reason we pay attention to our breathing is because it's the only thing that's moving. So it's a reference point for whether or not we're in the present. So it's really about coming back to the present, where not much is going on. So we do that, and we do that, and we do that, and it's boring, and it's painful, at least for me, maybe for you too. And you go on a 10-day meditation retreat, and you know, you think you're going to scream or cry or run away, and then maybe on day 8, you get kind of a glimpse of relaxation for a minute and a half. and then you keep on going. And what happens is that the more we do this, the more that quality of coming back leaks into our daily life. So, as of now, there's meditation practice and there's post-meditation practice. Post-meditation practice is the rest of your life. It's how do we apply our meditation practice? How do we apply what we're doing here to our life? How do we not lose our cool? So, this happens to everybody. If you think you're the only person in the room who has trouble with this, everybody in the room has trouble with this. Because we're human. Because we have these amygdalas, we get threatened, and then we have these responses. And the fight, flee, or freeze is actually called the three poisons in Buddhism. So it's desire, which is fleeing, ignorance or avoidance, which is freezing, and aggression, which is aggression, fighting. And these are what we work at. It's what our sort of raw material is, because we're human, because this is how it is. And we can talk about that for a while, but think of it as part of our evolution. And the next part of our evolution is working with the three poisons in a way that we're in charge rather than they're in charge. So when we're practicing meditation, we experience emotion, but we don't freak out because we're just sitting there. I mean, we could freak out on the cushion, but probably we're good enough not to. So the question is, when a trigger comes up, when we feel like fighting, fleeing, or freezing, when we feel like hitting the bottle or whatever it is we do, or fighting or dissociating, leaving our body and not being present. Can we notice that? So again, what we do when we meditate is we're training the muscle, the mental muscle of noticing and coming back. So meditation isn't really about staying on the breath. It's not the point. I mean, it's fine if you can do it. But the point is to train our ability to come back when we're not on the breath. That's really what we're doing here. It's training ourselves to notice when we're distracted and come back. So when we experience a threat, or when we experience something that causes anger, desire, dissociation, if we can notice that and just come back, then what happens is that the emotion becomes a physiological thing again. It's no longer in charge, right? We have reflexive verbs in English for emotions. I am angry. I am whatever, I am sad. I am fearful. It's an interesting grammar because it implies that there's no difference between me and the emotion. In other languages, it's sometimes it's about having the emotion rather than being the emotion, which is a much more accurate way of working with emotion. So instead of saying I am angry, maybe we can say I have anger in my body. This is what I'm experiencing, which turns it from an existential relationship with the emotion to a physiological relationship with the emotion. So, okay, I'm experiencing anger. Now what do I do? So if we can notice and come back, which is what we're training, and don't forget, when we notice and come back, it's with kindness. It's not about that there's a problem with being distracted. We can notice and come back when we're in the middle of screaming at somebody. It's always now. We always have a choice. And when we remember, we can just stop and just come back, just be present. And then we can decide what to do. We can always decide what to do. We can always notice when we're fixated. Notice that and just come back to the present. And you can feel the fixation wherever it manifests in your body. And just be present with it. And it doesn't mean it's going to go away or that impulse is going to go away or the impulse to flee or the anger. It's not about curing anything. It's not about fixing anything particularly. And we're not here to fix things. We're here to be present and decide what to do. We always have a choice. So the first noble truth of Buddhism is that we're going to suffer. Sooner or later, maybe all the time, just by virtue of being human. That's the way it is. So if that's the first noble truth, and the third noble truth is, well, let's do the second. The second is we suffer because there's a difference between the way things are and the way we want them to be. We always have some desire for something better. We think that there's something to feed here and that we're always looking in the future, always trying to change the past. I want things to be better. That's actually not the manifestation of suffering. It's actually the cause of suffering. Third noble truth is that actually we can stop suffering. And the fourth noble truth is the path of meditation, which is the path to the cessation of suffering. But what this means is there's a distinction between suffering and pain. So what we do when we notice our desire, aggression, or dissociation, avoidance, is we just come back and we can actually hang out in that pain. It's actually not as bad as we thought it was. We have a lot of fear around experiencing pain, and we think that, you know, if only I didn't feel pain, my life would be better. Well, everybody feels pain. That's the first noble truth. So if we can stay present with whatever's going on, that means we're in charge. when we lose our cool, we say, oh, I wasn't myself. Who were we? I was somebody else. And in fact, that's kind of true. It's sort of true. Because we were letting our emotions drive the train. It's not about suppressing emotion. It's not about avoiding emotion. Actually, it's the opposite. It's about really being willing to experience whatever's coming up. And, you know, we all have relationships where we get triggered and we trigger the other person, and, you know, it gets tough because we're in a cycle. Ram Dass, who was a great Hindu teacher, said, if you think you're enlightened, try spending a weekend with your family. we have these patterns with people, and they cause us to get triggered, and we freak out, and we act out. So the question is, can we notice this and come back? Can we notice it and come back? Can we notice it and come back? And, you know, it doesn't mean it's going to get better, but it does mean we have a choice. It does mean that we don't need to lose our cool. It means that we can actually work with our fear. Because down deep, that's really what the issue is. We're experiencing fear. Fear of conflict, fear of losing something, fear of not getting something. And if we look at fear as a bonfire, we can actually walk into the middle of the bonfire. And surprisingly, we don't get burned up. And it doesn't mean we don't experience the fear. Fearlessness is being willing to experience fear completely. Doesn't mean being without fear. So we can all be fearless right on the spot. It just means being willing to actually have that conflict. Be willing to say what you think. You know, be willing to be kind to ourselves. You know, and that this is an extremely important point, which is a lot of our aggression can get turned inwards. You know, and we think, oh, I'm just not a good person, or, you know, I have this pattern, and I must mean I'm a terrible person. And it doesn't. You know, that's kind of a sort of an extra layer that we have in the West. I want to tell you a little story about that, which is that the Dalai Lama had a conference of American Buddhist teachers, I think it was 20 years ago. And Sharon Salzberg, who many of you may know, was telling him that, well, gee, one of the big problems I have with my students is that they're really hard on themselves. They don't like themselves. Some of them have self-hatred. So the Dalai Lama, who speaks English, says, I don't understand. And he turns to his translator and says, what does she say? And they go back and forth in Tibetan. And he says, okay, explain it again. She explains it again. Anyway, they go back and forth for an hour. And the Dalai Lama finally says, oh, okay, I see what you mean. We don't have that in Tibet. right? It's a Western thing, and it's cultural. And it may have something to do with this idea of original sin, which doesn't exist. Actually, what exists is original goodness, basic goodness. So if we think we're bad people, just don't believe that. Okay? One of the things we can do is when we talk to ourselves about, you know, what a crumb bum we are, we can actually, if we can notice it, we can come back to the present and we can say, I don't believe you. And just keep on doing that. I don't believe you. Just a habit we have, and it's a long time habit. I don't believe you. That's another way of keeping our cool, because we don't need to believe the self-talk to the extent it's negative. So, to summarize, in Tibetan Buddhism, there's a way of talking about the Dharma, about the teachings of the Buddha, called threefold logic. And there are different kinds of threefold logic, and one of them is called view, practice, action. And the view is understanding the phenomenology of meditation and what's really going on. The practice is the particular kind of meditation we're doing. And the action is, how do we put our meditation practice into action based on the view? So here, the view is that we can be in charge of ourselves, that our emotions actually aren't in charge, and we can be, and that we're going to experience pain, and we can't stop that, but we can relate to it differently. We don't have to try to avoid it. And if we are willing to simply be present, it just is what it is. And we can put a gap in between our experience, that trigger, which brings up the emotion, and how we respond to it, so that we can notice the impulse to fight, flee, or freeze, but we don't have to follow it. We don't have to be that, because emotions are simply physiological. The practice is we just sit there, and whatever comes up is okay. We're okay. We can notice it, come back with kindness. Nothing's a problem. We're just sitting here. We're not doing anything, so we're not creating any problems. Just sit here, notice, come back, come back, come back. And the action is, the more we sit, the more we can actually start to put some space in between our emotion that comes up and what we do about it. So, let's have a discussion. Any questions or comments? Yes, sir. Please wait. Oh, you have the mic? Good.
In the fight, freeze, or flee concept, in this particular cultural existence that we have now, freezing, wouldn't that give you the gap time to get back into the moment as quickly as possible? Because if you're in a work situation, you can't fight your boss, you'll be tossed in jail. You can't run away because you're in a professional environment. So freezing actually will give you the, freezing is the, actually, it's not the ideal way to go, but it's the best way to go. It's the least of the evils, I guess. Because I'm thinking that in that moment that you freeze, it gives you the time to get back into the moment and then to get back into the calm state. That...
Well, so we don't really have a choice about this because we're all patterned in a particular way, whether it's genetic or whether it's cultural. I'm a freezer, and I freeze, you know, when my wife decides that she wants to talk to me about something I don't want to talk about, and she'll start talking to me, and I might change the subject without even noticing. And she'll say to me, excuse me, you're not listening to me. And that's freezing. That's dissociating. It's like it's leaving the body, leaving the room. So when your boss comes in, that might be one way of approaching it. Another, depending on who you are, you might become angry. Doesn't mean you're going to act out. What it means is you're going to have this impulse, or you might really want to go for a cigarette after the boss leaves the room. Let me get that nicotine in my lungs, or whatever it is you do to make yourself feel better. So it's more of an internal process than necessarily an external process. And it was an external process sort of earlier on in our evolution. But because we have a human brain and a prefrontal cortex, it's kind of changed how we relate to these triggers, and it becomes much more complicated.
Thank you.
Not sure it's a question, it's something that's coming in my mind as you're speaking of the three stages. Where does blame come in?
Blame?
Blame.
Mm. Yeah, that's a good one. Blame is aggression. So there's a lot of teachings about blame in Buddhism. And the idea is that it's actually okay to take the blame in situations. What typically happens is if there's a problem and I get blamed for it, I might say, yeah, okay, I get it. And let's talk about it. And as soon as the blame gets taken, the aggression starts to dissipate because there's nothing to push against anymore. There's nothing to fight. Yeah, I agree, it's my fault. And then all of a sudden, it starts to fall away. Now, it may be that it is my fault to an extent, or maybe that it isn't, but if I'm willing to take it, then instead of escalating the aggression and turning it into a big hot mess, we can actually dissolve it. And the idea is that it doesn't matter if we take the blame or not. You know, what's preventing us from taking the blame? I mean, I'm not saying we should, you know, confess to things we didn't do. But, you know, if there's some problem where it's reasonable to diffuse a situation, it's fine to accept it, as opposed to trying to be right.
And then the desire to blame is, so that's accepting the blame, but the desire to blame is in the aggression side.
It's also fear. Mm-hmm. It's not my fault. Uh-huh. You know, how often have we said this? It's not my fault. Mm-hmm. Actually, it usually is, at least partially. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. Because whatever happened already happened, and the question is now what do we do? Come back to now. We're always coming back to the present. What's the best way to handle this situation? And it may be to take the blame. And it may be to, you know, try to stop the other person from freaking out. But, you know, it's interesting if you, you know, if you are a political person, everybody's always blaming everybody else. You know, and it's really, you know, it was the Secret Service's fault. You know, it's just nonsense. And it's about fear of actually taking responsibility for what's actually going on.
Thank you.
Okay, this might be a little bit of a devil's advocate, but I mean, what happens in the situation where it's really most effective to say something back immediately, quickly? Someone said something really rude to you, and you want to say mm-hmm. something right then. Hey, that was rude.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is that reacting? Is that contemplative? Because it's part of life.
Mm-hmm. So it depends. You know, you're the only one who knows. If someone says something rude to you and the appropriate response, and, you know, who's to say what the appropriate response is, but you think the appropriate response is to say, you know, you're being rude. The question is, can you say it not out of emotion, but making a choice as to how to respond? And it's a split-second thing. It's not, you know, okay, I'm feeling this emotion, what am I going to do, blah, blah, blah. It's, if we're present on the spot, then it's just what's happening. And then we do whatever it is we do, and then see if it worked or not. See if it made sense, and notice whether we were acting out of anger or out of some kind of precision. You know, in Buddhist terminology, the flip side of anger is precision.
What do you mean the flip side?
It's the same energy, but it's the enlightened aspect of it.
Makes sense.
If you could expand on the subject about suffering, because you said suffering.
Yep.
Because you said it's part of human life, no? It's mm-hmm. an everyday thing. But I wonder, like, how can we help ourselves and others? Like, I work for a social services agency, and you see everything. You hear everything and you feel everything. You know, someone in particular, like, you know, has suffered the entire life, you know, from childhood abuse and abandonment and all that.
Yep.
And now this person is actually a human, an adult, but is still carrying all that, you know. So how could I say to this person, oh, it's okay to suffer. No, oh, you'll be okay, get over that, you know, because I don't say that. But it's sort of like, it's almost impossible to help that person in a sense. So I don't know what would be your feedback on that part.
Okay, that's a really great question. So, this is about compassion. And one way of talking about compassion is I understand how you feel, I can feel how you feel, and I want to help you. It's one definition is having those three motivations or three experiences. And what meditation practice does is develop the basis for compassion. There's also various compassion practices that we do here. One of the issues that I've always had is emotional contagion, which is to say that if I see someone who's suffering, then I feel how you feel and I understand how you feel, but that's it. And so there's this quality of, you know, you feel empathy and you experience this person who's suffering terribly, and you know, you feel what can I do? It's really awful. When it turns into compassion, there's been a bunch of studies on this, but the really interesting thing about it is that we start to separate from the other person. It's not like I feel how you feel, I understand how you feel, and I am you. It's I want to help you. I'm here, you're there. You know, I'm really sorry, but what can I do to help in this particular situation? And you know, the practice that we do is great, and you know, maybe it's not the most useful thing to do in another situation. The most useful thing to do is something else. But it's good for us, because what it does is it brings us back to the present. It brings us back to compassion. It brings us back to how can I help? And you know, it also brings us back to, you know, am I experiencing some kind of secondary trauma here from my emotion, from the fact that actually it's not my compassion isn't perfect, and I'm experiencing emotional contagion. And what can I do about that? That's an entire other conversation. But the point is that in order to help others, we actually have to take care of ourselves. It's, you know, it's the thing where, you know, the masks come down. Put your mask on first before you help the person next to you. Because if you don't, you're going to suffocate, and so will that person. So we actually have to take care of ourselves and have some kind of kindness to ourselves in order to be able to properly help others with compassion and without... you know, and being able to work with this, the problem of reflected suffering. Does that make sense?
Okay. Hi. Just to piggyback off of what was being said before about emotional contagion, I sometimes have found that in the past, I'm more likely to lose my cool when in the presence of someone else who's angry.
Can you speak up, please?
Sorry. I'm more likely to lose my cool when that other person I'm facing is angry.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'm more likely to, you know, freeze when someone else is frozen or shut down. Mm-hmm. And when you say taking care of yourself first, respect to meditation, what does that mean in that moment? When you're facing that person, let's say, who's angry on the subway, or you know, who's, you know, you're having trouble getting through to, who's, you know, acting out in such and such a way, and how in that moment can you sort of, are you able to then take care of yourself with that meditative oxygen mask?
Mm-hmm. So the idea of taking care of yourself is to actually do the practice and actually study the teachings and actually work with how we react, work with how we respond to situations like that. So, you know, in the context when I was talking to this lady, it's about, you know, give yourself a break, you know, do your practice, come back, take care of yourself, and don't think that, like many activists think, I've got to spend 24/7 doing this because, you know, otherwise something terrible is going to happen. Maybe 12/7 or maybe 9/5 is better. Maybe you'll do a better job that way, because then you actually have time to take care of yourself, and then be refreshed enough to, you know, give it your best shot. In your examples, it's really about coming back, what we're doing when we're coming back is taking care of ourselves. We're not letting our emotions be in charge. We're in charge. So just coming back, coming back, coming back, and then deciding what to do. Okay, well, thank you all very much. And there's a little tea and reception outside, so see you next time.
Thank you, Robert Chinder. Visit our website, nynachimbala.org, for all of our upcoming classes and weekend retreats. There's the 7-day retreat in August, and then in the fall, beginning in September, many great classes and weekend Shambhala trainings. So check it out. Email us at podcast@shambhalanyc.org. Your questions, comments, suggestions, home laundry remedies, whatever you got. If you happen to live in a different city, there's probably a Shambhala Meditation Center near you. But if you are in the New York City area, come say hi. Come to our weekly Dharma gathering. It's every Tuesday night at 7 o'clock. You can hear these talks live and in person, meet the teachers, meet the other people who ask all these great questions, and enjoy lovely receptions. All right. Next time.